Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots reggae, dub and sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Kareni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
Hi everyone, my name is Tieni from Titanio Dakota, and you're listening to Island Music.
Search up ABC Island Music to listen online or find it on the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Kia ora, Nissan Bulivinaka, Yakwe, no ia e Māori, and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm your host, Aggie Dubow, and thank you for tuning into our show today. Coming up, calls for women's menstrual leave to increase to 12 days per year. The President Balao's Senate says he'll seek legal advice to clear his name after the US accused him of taking bribes from Chinese companies.
I have not get any money from any Chinese people to bribe me for what? Any Chinese need me for what? What they want in Palau that they don't get, so they need me to give it to them.
Plans to the Panguna mine on Bougainville are causing anxiety on the island.
We have not been consulted on the whole development of reopening of Panguna mine.
And New Zealand Immigration denies a two-year-old Tongan boy to stay and to not stay and receive life-saving treatment. All that and more here on Pacific Beat, where we come to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Tagio Tumas, thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, we start in Fiji, where there's a call for women to be given a significant increase in paid menstrual leave, up from 3 days to 12 per year. Nalini Singh from the Fiji Women's Rights Movement says women's menstrual leave should also not be taken up by sick leave. The movement is sparking national discussion about gender equality in workplaces. So, who better to discuss this issue than Nalini Singh herself? With that, I say Yandere, Nalini, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Yandere Vinaka, Aggie, and thank you for having me on your show.
Absolutely. Let's get straight into it. I mean, what is the driving force behind the need to increase menstrual leave? And can I ask Nalini, is this something that's sort of been in the planning for a while now?
Yes, well, you know, in the work that the Fiji Women's Rights Movement has been doing for decades now, we have been at the forefront, you know, in terms of advocating for better laws for women, removing discrimination and sexist elements in the laws. So we have been part of our employment reforms for a very long time, from you know, as early as the early 2000s, where we advocated for the inclusion of you know, sexual harassment clauses in our laws. And this move to include menstruation leave as a separate leave for women comes from the conversations we've been having with women, young women in the workforce, both formal and informal. And the fact that across the Pacific and in Fiji, the subject discussion around menstruation, menopause, is almost nil because it's considered such a taboo topic. So we have been working to remove that stigma and discrimination around the topic. And with those conversations, we're finding out that there are so many women and young women who are suffering in silence from the pain and you know, the other issues that they go through physically when they are on their periods. So this moves come this call comes from those conversations and listening to those women that, you know, need to have some rest and respite when they are, you know, experiencing their periods and their menopausal stage in life, because there are so many who at the later stage in menopause, they quit their jobs because, you know, it's almost unbearable. Now, if we translate this to girls, you know, menstrual hygiene is also an issue for that, for them as well in schools. Most schools don't have adequate wash facilities or menstrual hygiene management facilities. And many girls also, you know, miss schools too. So this issue we are bringing up right now, because this is the right time. The Fijian government has embarked on a law reform for our employment law. And we think that, you know, it's great that they have recognized menstruation as a condition that needs to be looked at and have put in provisions. But we are saying that instead of 3 days in the sick leave, there should be more, because for the women that need this particular leave, 3 days is not enough. And it's not a sickness. It's a condition that they, you know, go through without choice every month. So put in a provision of 12 months, and then let's see for those that need it. And they will be grateful for having this particular leave accounted for in our legislation.
Mm. And as you said, it's gone from 3, and now you're proposing 12 days per year. Can I ask, though, then, Nalini, why you believe menstrual leave should be recognised as a workplace right rather than just treated as a standard sick leave?
Yes, because menstruation affects half the population of the country. It affects only women or only females. And there are many ways, different ways in which women experience it. And for the longest time, no one has spoken up about it. It's not an issue that's been discussed. It's not recognized as a public health issue, which is also what we are saying, that rather than just looking at it as a reproductive health issue, it needs to be seen as a public health issue, because, you know, there are elements that, you know, of what we experience that have to be addressed in a public way. And it's high time that governments, even developing governments like ours, need to start looking at, well, how do we cater for the needs for half the population of the country, and also look at ways in which we can build confidence with women who need to or want to come into the workforce. But, you know, this could be one of the reasons that is holding them back, because we are still significantly behind in terms of reaching the gender balance when we are looking at women in the workforce. So, you know, having government show targeted policy responses to what women need is going to be beneficial immediately, in medium term, and in, of course, in the long term. And this cannot be seen as discrimination, because, you know, when we look at the international convention that Fiji has signed on to, the Convention on the Elimination of all forms of discrimination against women, it clearly says that we can't be using menstruation, maternity or pregnancies as grounds for not hiring women. So we have to hire women because they are part of our economic society, and they are great contributors, both paid and unpaid. But often, you know, the issues they would like to raise is never considered in the mainstream. So there are many different ways of looking at this discussion. One is that we are very glad that this is a conversation out in the open and people are expressing their views, because that's what's needed on this issue. We need to express our views. There are many, many women and men who have come up and said that this is great, that at least we are having this conversation. The next step will be to work out ways of how we can implement this without outrightly dismissing it all as an issue that, you know, we cannot implement.
Mm. Well, Nalini, what practical steps should employers take now then, knowing that, you know, there's this sort of policy debate continuing at the moment?
Yes, I mean, this discussion is not a simple one, I agree. You know, it's a very technical one. And all parties to this discussion, well, perhaps we all need to come to the table and discuss this and work out some resolution. Perhaps we need a tiered approach. Perhaps, you know, one of the largest employers, which is the Fiji government with the civil service, maybe we need to see a trial with them to see how civil service would work with this, because, you know, it's one of the largest employers of women in any case. Maybe we need to be looking at subsidies or tax incentives for micro and small medium enterprises so that you know, they would be able to meet the labor compliance costs. We need a lot of training, a lot of technical support and training for all types of businesses, not just small, you know, to understand the obligations that come with it. And maybe also a tiered penalty structure as well, depending on the size of the business. And, you know, nothing is going to be possible until we have strong partnerships to strengthen, you know, enterprise human resource systems and all the other policy documents and guidelines, etc. And finally, I think we need to see if women-led businesses could be given some targeted grants so that, you know, they could absorb some of the transitional costs in the very beginning. So there are many different ways of seeing how we can implement this. So I would suggest that, you know, more discussion is needed, definitely, without outrightly throwing this, you know, issue out, saying that, no, it's too expensive for all for businesses. It's bad for the economy. We are a developing country, and, you know, we can't implement this. You know, we have to look at all the different examples we have in the world and see how did they do it. You know, and what were the obstacles in the beginning and how did they get around to it? Because we cannot use the fact that we are a developing country as an excuse. And we cannot say that, oh, there are so many other issues as well. Let's fix those first and not this, because this is an opportunity we have right now. And the discussion is now on the table. So let's do this, and let's not perhaps rush into assumptions that, you know, there's going to be widespread abuse of this. Every entitlement that an employer gives, there's potential for that to be abused. And in fact, you know, there has been abuse of some previous leave entitlements, but that does not mean that a majority of those that use this in good faith and you know, apply that in the ways that these entitlements are meant for. You know, they're grateful for it. We have a stronger workforce. At the moment, we are taking, you know, this issue as, you know, that is not going to work for us. I mean, how do we know that? You know, have we spoken to all the women in our workforces to realize that's, you know, there are many who could be doing much better, you know, if employers, through their duty of care, also, you know, grant these leaves for women, those women who really need it.
Absolutely. Well, Nalini, I just want to say thank you very much for coming on the show this morning just to share a little bit of an insight. We will definitely keep in touch with you as to seeing how this progresses on. But thank you again, Vinaka, for your time, Nalini.
Thank you so much, Angie.
And that is Nalini Singh, Executive Director for the Fiji Women's Rights Movement here on Pacific Beat.
Join Natasha Matin for Sisters Let's Talk, a program that explores the issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
Salitiana, do you encounter vaccine hesitancy, particularly on social media?
Not much now. In the 2013 EPI coverage survey, we found out that there was a 0.9% of hesitancy.
Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, the president of Palau's Senate says he'll seek legal advice to clear his name after the United States accused him of taking bribes from Chinese companies. Hawkins Bal and Marshall Islands Mayor Anderson Jaban have both been hit with U.S. travel bans imposed by the U.S. State Department. Mr. Jaban is accused of siphoning off American compensation funds meant for Marshall Islanders affected by U.S. nuclear testing. Mr. Bal is senior Palauan politician, says he's shocked by the allegations and has no idea where the information came from.
I just got it today and I don't know what's going on, and I don't know. I don't know why they know what I'm doing, and the Republic of Palau don't know anything about this. So I don't know where they got this information. I think that's my statement. They just don't like me because I'm supporting China. not because I'm supporting their bad habits or bad what, but I support them because mainland China is the biggest investor, biggest supporter of our economy.
I was going to ask you about this. They're saying corruption. What's your response to that, corruption and bribery? Have you ever taken money, gifts, or trips or favors from China-based individuals or companies?
I have not get any money from any Chinese people to bribe me for what? Any Chinese need me for what? What they want in Palau that they don't get, so they need me to give it to them. Many Chinese have land in Palau. They have acquired a lease of land. I don't have any land lease to Chinese people. And why should I get money from them for what purpose?
What will be your next step? What will you do now that this you've been given a travel ban? What do you plan on doing?
If they give me travel ban, it's okay because I don't need to go to the United States for what. I have no intention of going to States. I don't know why. Why should, if I go to the United States, maybe because I have a meeting to attend, like going to Washington, D.C. or to New York, if they invited me, they should show the bribery I'm getting from. They don't just say I'm getting bribery and supporting them.
Are you calling on the U.S. to publish that information that they have?
I really don't know. I just got it today. If I want, I will. Maybe I make appointment to the ambassador of the United States in Palau and ask him, what's this? Can you give me the information about this?
So what will you do to try and clear your name?
I have to find a lawyer to find a way to clear my name. I don't know how to clear my name because I have nothing, haven't done anything. I just, my personal view, I just maybe publish in the newspaper that I have not done anything wrong. If the United States have anything wrong, provide evidence to the government of Palau so the government of Palau prosecuted me. Because our system of government is like United States. If you commit a crime, then you will be prosecuted. So if I have commit a crime, then United States show the proof, show the evidence to the government of Palau.
Sir, thank you very much for your time today to speak to Radio Australia. Any final words from you about your situation?
I am one of the strongest supporters of the United States government in Palau. I was born and raised during the administration of the United States and been under the United States for almost 80 years. So my mind and my heart is toward the United States government and people. So I don't know how they come up with this news about me. This news is, I don't know whether it affects my political career, I don't know.
And that there is Hawkins Bowler, President of Palau Senate, speaking to Pacific Beat shortly after the US imposed the travel ban. And Pacific Beat has sought comment from former Marshalls Mayor Anderson Diabas. Well, the Director of Customs in French Polynesia says operational realism is why a ship found carrying 5 tons of cocaine was released, along with its crew, after the drugs were destroyed at sea. French armed forces dumped the haul into the ocean after intercepting the MV Raider in international waters near French Polynesia 2 weeks ago. Afterwards, the ship and its crew of 11 Ecuadorian and Honduran nationals were allowed to continue sailing. French Polynesia's custom director, Sergei Pusetti, says the crew are minor players in the illicit drug trade, and bringing them and the drugs back to shore takes up too much time and resources. He says destroying the cocaine is the harshest blow local authorities can deal to the transnational drug cartels.
We cannot say that the traffic has suddenly exploded, but rather that we have made significant progress, I think. In French Polynesia is a natural transit point on the route between America production centers and the ocean's market. And if the seizures are breaking record, it is thanks to the action plan of the French services and I think to the mobilization of our maritime and customs resources that in Polynesia we have implemented a very very proactive plan to combat narcotics. And these seizures are also the result of the cooperation with the other services in the region, notably Australian Customs and Australian Police. And I believe that international cooperation is certainly the most effective weapon to combating trafficking.
In one of the seizures, authorities dumped the cocaine at sea before releasing the vessel and crew, and that's due to legal and detention capacity constraints. Whose responsibility is it to arrest these individuals now?
Yeah, this is a very good question, because the cocaine, it's true, was destroyed at sea, which is a procedure commonly used in other parts of the world because of the importance of the traffic. It is a decision based on operational realism, because in the wilderness of the Pacific, bringing tons of drugs back to land for incineration requires colossal resources at the expense of surveillance. And by destroying the drugs immediately, we deliver the harshest blow to the cartels, a direct financial loss. And our priority is to neutralize the drugs to financially strangle criminal organization. And for your question, as for the sailors, they are mainly employed. We are not at the high level in the organizations.
How confident are you that the crew will be held accountable for their actions?
Let me tell you, I think there's no one escape justice in the long run. They are free, but the identities of the crew members are passed on. The electronic data saved on ships and analyzed with our partners in Australia or New Zealand or United States, then this seller may be free to move, but they are now monitoring at the international level.
What do the customs service in French Polynesia need in order to stay ahead of cartels who seem to be adapting rapidly to enforcement?
It's difficult because to stay ahead of the cartel that quickly adapt to control measures, it is necessary for us to constantly renew working methods and in particular to develop cooperation. This is why we are working more and more efficiently and closely with services from the other Pacific states, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, United States, Japan, Fiji, etc. And this is also why we are equipping ourselves with significant resources like ships, planes, and scanners to be able to develop this fight against these criminal traffics. But beyond that, what is most important in sharing information with all the services? And I believe that on this matter, we have made amazing progress over the past 2 years with the Australian, New Zealand, American, and also Canadian services. So what we can increase is seizures. Then we trust between the French customs and the Australian customs are never been higher. I should also be said that we are in a positive dynamic that shows that the French customs in Polynesia is effective and motivated. And I believe that is something very important for the other services on the Pacific States. We work in close cooperation on full trust with the French customs.
And that there is Serge Bouchetti, the customs director in French Polynesia. Well, if you just joined us, thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie DeBoer, and here's just a quick recap of what's been on the show so far. We've had calls for women's menstrual leave to increase from 3 to 12 days per year. Also, the president of Bilal Senate says he's going to seek legal advice to clear his name after the United States accused him of taking bribes from Chinese companies. And also, we just heard from the operational realism is why a ship found carrying 5 tons of cocaine was released along with its crew after the the drugs were destroyed at sea. Still to come, we've got plans to the Panguna mine on Bougainville, actually causing anxiety on the island, which is still grappling with traumas of the past. Also, the London Broncos are currently third on the ladder and look set to make the playoffs. And at the end of the show, we'll have New Zealand immigration. We'll be talking about New Zealand immigration, who've denied a two-year-old Tongan boy to not stay in New Zealand and receive life-saving treatment. But right now, it's your news wrap. It is Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Agita Bol. And right now, as always, when you hear that beautiful sting, it's our producer coming through to share the headlines from across the region. And today, special guest, it's been a while. We have Jordan, who's in the studio with me this morning. How's it going?
Hello, hello. Good morning. Yeah. Here I am on the whisper of a beautiful sting.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And I must say, it's always girl power. I love our brothers who come through and help us out. But it's just nice to have another woman in the studio.
I'm here to represent.
Yes, there we go. Thank you very much. Look, there is quite a few things that are happening. I believe we start in Samoa, where it's been alleged fake police reports are being issued to give seasonal workers a clean slate.
Yeah, so this reporting is coming from the Samoa Observer. A bit of context about this story. For seasonal workers to travel to Australia under the seasonal worker scheme, mm-hmm. they are required to have a clean police record. But Samoa Observer is now saying that a source close to the Ministry of Commerce, Industry and Labour has revealed that police documents, including clearance forms, are allegedly being falsified. Wow. So people with prior convictions have a clean slate in order to travel to Australia.
Wow. But what does a normal police clearance usually involve, though, John?
So normally, if someone is going to be travelling under the seasonal workers scheme, they would go to the police to do a police clearance check, which costs about 30 Samoan tala.
Yes.
And police officers have about 2 days to do a background check once a person supplies their documents and then pays.
Wow. But I'm wondering, though, have we actually heard or any news from the Samoa government about this?
No, not yet. So, yeah, since Samoa Observer has reported about these alleged falsified documents and what's going on there, they have put questions to the ministry, but there has been no response just yet.
Okay, okay. Thanks for that. We head to Tonga now because police have intercepted a major haul of undeclared ammunition into the country. What are the details here?
Yeah, so an 81-year-old man has been caught attempting to smuggle over 5,000 rounds of ammunition into Tonga. The discovery was made during inspections between December last year and January this year mm-hmm. when consignments were coming in from a range of different countries, yeah. Including from the US and New Zealand. That ammunition now, those 5,000 rounds, have now been handed over to police.
An 81-year-old. Oh, gosh.
Yes, yes. In the old age.
Yes. They're still using. Oh, goodness. Okay, finally, I believe an Australian-based cover importer is demanding subsidies from the Vanuatu government. What's happening here?
Yeah, so this is a report coming from the Vanuatu Daily Post. A Ni Vanuatu importer who's based in Australia has said that Vanuatu Kava is struggling to compete with products from Fiji and Tonga, which are cheaper because of government subsidies in those countries. So the importer is calling on the Vanuatu government to also provide subsidies to level the playing field. And of course, these calls are coming as Vanuatu battles a kava shortage. The government there has discussed trying to boost local production with a plan to plant millions of new kava plants by 2030. But as this importer has said, it's sort of in dire straits at the moment.
Yeah.
Around the kava situation.
Very unfortunate, but I do have to ask though, Jordan, have you ever tasted kava?
I have tasted Fijian
kava. Okay.
Kava.
And
man, it was strong on me. As someone who has not had it before,
yes.
I had two little sips.
And you were done. I know, it's an acquired taste, isn't it, for many? But even though with Vanuatu, because I've heard that they're the strongest type of kava to drink.
I have heard that too, and I don't know if I'd be able to handle it.
Yeah, I don't even think I can get past Fiji or Tongan kava, so yeah. But look, as always, thank you very much, Jordan, for coming through and giving us our headlines from across the region right here on Pacific Beat.
Want to immerse yourself in sport and the stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Sam Wykes, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll also bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to football, and everything in between. Fresh Off the Field, Thursdays at 4 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Me taki ma'ata. Thank you for tuning in to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Eki Dubol. Well, plans to the Panguna mine on Bougainville are causing anxiety on the island, which is still grappling with traumas of the past. It's one of the world's largest copper deposits, potentially worth tens of billions, that many locals hope will bankroll independence from Papua New Guinea. Panguna was also the epicenter of a bloody decade-long civil war, and the Bougainville government's out-of-the-blue announcement that it will partner with an Indian mining company to reopen it has caught people off guard. Papua New Guinea correspondent Marion Farr reports.
On the island of Bougainville, Raphael Evenu still remembers the violent civil war that claimed up to 15,000 lives 3 decades ago. As a young man during the conflict, he says he was thrown in jail by Papua New Guinean soldiers.
Oh, it was horrible, awful. Took our rights away and then everything.
Central to the crisis was Panguna, one of the world's largest open-cut mines at the time. But in 1989, it was forced to close as tensions broke out over benefit sharing, foreign workers and environmental concerns. Now, more than 30 years later, that mine appears to be on a rapid path to reopening, and Mr. Evenu is worried about a lack of consultation.
We want to help the government, but at the same time, on the same token, we must be consulted.
Panguna has one of the world's largest copper deposits, and the Bougainville government wants to use the mine to bankroll its ambitions to become an independent nation by next year. At the moment, the autonomous region generates just 5 to 6% of its revenue internally, relying on Papua New Guinea for the rest. But Panguna could change that, with the mine expected to generate $40 billion if it's reopened. Oliver Nobertau is Project Director of the Australia-Papua New Guinea Network at the Lowy Institute.
So in order to achieve those independence aspirations, they need this economic injection.
But concerns have been raised over how negotiations are being handled. In November, the Bougainville government signed a secretive deal with Indian mining company Lloyds Metals and Energy Limited, agreeing to partner on the Panguna development. That came as a surprise to Panguna landowner Philip Miriori.
We have not been consulted on the whole development of reopening of Panguna mine.
Bougainville Copper Limited, the company that owns the Panguna exploration license, says it also wasn't informed about the deal. It was running a separate process to identify a development partner and had chosen CMOC, a Chinese mining company, as its first choice. But 2 weeks ago, the government, which owns a majority share in Bougainville Copper, directed the company to abandon negotiations with CMOC and pursue a partnership with Lloyds Metals instead. This week, two long-serving members of the Bougainville Copper Board handed in their resignations. For Oliver Nobertau, it's a sign of growing tensions.
It seems to be sort of irreconcilable differences that are causing board members to leave.
He wants to know exactly how and why Lloyds Metals became the government's pick.
But this should be a question for other Bougainvillians as well, more so when we're talking about good governance and transparency as to how this decision was made.
The Bougainville government, Lloyds Metals and Bougainville Copper have not responded to the ABC's questions. Oliver Nobertau is urging them all to tread carefully, given the tragedies of the past.
This is the exact concern that a lot of people have. If this is not managed well, could this lead to more conflict on the island?
A fear that no one wants to see realised.
And that report there from Marion Farr and Thikla Kunya. Now, Moria Moria is one of 7 Papua New Guinean players who are enjoying a strong season with the London Broncos and the UK's Betfred Championship. The London Broncos are currently third on the ladder, and look set to make the playoffs. In an interview with ABC Pacific, Moria Moria says having a number of fellow Kumuls join the team was a key factor in him making the decision to play for the London Broncos.
I think it made it a lot easier come moving here and seeing like familiar faces with you and every day made it easier for us to transition.
and the London Broncos co-owned by Australian rugby league legend and former Brisbane Bronco Darren Lockyer. Lockyer helped get the Kumuls players onto the team, more than just locking in professional career in Europe. Moria Moria says it's a privilege to represent his country.
Rugby league is the national sport there, so to represent PNG in the national level and to do it in here in London it's pretty special.
And that was Papua New Guinean rugby league player Moria Moria and current fullback for the London Broncos. Now, the governor of PNG's Madang province, Ramzi Pariwa, has joined with locals in Madang town who carried out its biggest ever clean-a-thon. The drive to spruce up the local environment saw Governor Pariwa urged several business owners to fix their sewage and waste systems within 24 hours and take greater responsibility for their waste management. Godwin Ikki has been talking to Special Project Officer Jenny Coy to find out more about how the clean-a-thon unfolded.
He's taken initiatives since coming to office as the governor, 23, 24, at his own timing and at his own initiative by putting out rubbish drums last year and taking part in organized cleaning activities. Last year, the Public Prosecution Office under the Police Department organized clean-a-thons for Madang. So it was an initiative by the Police Department of Madang Province, which was a community initiative to gather community members in Madang to come out and clean up the places. So governor's vision is that we start with the clean-a-thon of the Madang, as Madang town is the headquarter of the province. The cleanliness reflects the province as a whole. And this year, as the patron of the clean-a-thon program activity, his vision is to clean up the place physically and psychologically. We clean up our mindset for a better Madang and improved version of the province. So that's his vision for the province as he continues to do clean-a-thon, taking part in the community program.
Right. Now, we also saw videos of Governor. He was going into, you know, Asian shops. So can you just confirm with us Governor's, you know, presence, with the Chinese shop in Madang town?
As part of the clean-a-thon, the latest clean-a-thon that happened, while cleaning around town, he noticed wastage and sewage problems. And that's what led him to the specific Chinese shop to inform them and especially warn them as well to ensure that proper drainages are done. So it was part of the clean-a-thon program that led him to, while he was cleaning around the town, he saw those drainage issues that were supposed to be fixed by the companies that were operating around town.
And has town mayor and, of course, health authorities come forward, be part of the clean-a-thon or also go in line with governor's vision as the patron?
Previous clean-a-thon, yes, different business houses and government bodies have come out to clean around. And for this year, it's the first clean-a-thon that took place last Saturday. It's an initiative that will continue monthly, and we believe that as we continue, more stakeholders will come out and be part of the activity, and in which area and capacity that they are responsible for, they will also look into those areas as well.
What was the reaction from public?
Public were very happy, and it motivated them to also come out to speak up. The recent OI ban and smoking ban in public places enforced by the authorities has also cleaned up the place, and more people are happy to see that the town is going back to its former beauty, and they also want to take responsibility in coming out in the continuous clean-a-thons that will be happening monthly. So people seeing governor out on the streets, they all want to come out and participate and be part of the clean-a-thon as well.
Are there other areas that governor might also want to look into, such as, you know, petty crimes in the area and other illegal activities? Perhaps many of our youths, you know, get involved in these things, but other areas where governor may want to also look into to bring Madang back to its former glory?
Yes, he has done a lot over the years, and it's just coming into fruition and people are seeing it. But he's been working behind the scenes for the past 2-3 years, and we have a provincial events committee that has been formed by the provincial executive council under the chairmanship of the governor, who are promoting tourism and promoting the province through various events that they are hosting. And we're also looking at, like, governors focusing on sports and education for especially the youth, who will concentrate on those areas and reduce law and order issues or social issues that are happening in the province.
Is this the way forward for better Madang in future?
Yes, he has a bigger vision. He has a Madang Provincial Integrated Development Plan, which has a lot of things that he wants to carry out for the province to see develop towards the city. And as we work together, we believe that a lot of things will come into place with the right mindset. We'll be able to bring back Madang to a better place for everyone to come visit and to live in. I'd like to see everyone take responsibility for the province in making sure we keep our rubbish, you know, have them throw it out at the proper place or take it home and throw it away, and ensure that we all participate and take ownership of and beautifying our province. Governor has done a lot, which we are finally seeing come to fruition in the province, and he's got a lot of plans and development initiatives currently being conducted and in the pipeline to continue as well. So he's young, he's vibrant, he's humble, and Medang will see a lot happen in his term in government.
And that's Jenny Coy, Special Projects Officer from the Medang Governor's Office. She was talking to Godwin Eke. Right, the New Zealand government's refusal to grant a new visa to a critically ill Tongan boy has left his family devastated. Immigration New Zealand has declined a visa for 2-year-old Jonathan Ta'iloa, who sustained a severe brain injury in 2024. Despite his medical care being taken off, support from doctors and thousands of dollars spent for legal fees, Immigration New Zealand have advised that Jonathan must leave the country once his current visa expires. Well, to join us to unpack this more is his mother, Kalolaine Ta'iloa, with that I say malo tau mai pomponingi kalo, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Malo tau mau ke pomponingi, and thank you, Agnes, for this great opportunity for allowing me to join you today online. I am grateful to be here because of Jonathan's story is so important, and I believe that by sharing it today, it can really help to understand others what happened and our current situation is. Thank you.
No worries. Kalo, I know that this is a very sensitive time and, of course, everything that's going on with Jonathan. Do you mind just briefly sharing with us how Jonathan actually became so sick?
Thank you, Agnes. Jonathan was born healthy here in New Zealand. Jonathan is a younger twin of William. Jonathan got sick after he turned one, and the beginning, it was just a running nose and a cough, and he was told it's just a cold. I took him to the GP at first for a checkup and to see the situation that at that moment for Jonathan. So we were advised and we're told by the GP with medicines to just keep giving his the medicines and to monitor him with the medicines. The doctor was happy with the situation Jonathan was at that moment, that I can monitor with the medicines at home. So I was sent home with medicines with Jonathan just to look after. And I, as a mom, saw there was no changes. There was no changes after days of the medicines that I was given to him. So I decided again to take him again to the hospital, thinking this is where there will be lots of specialist equipment, that they will do more checkup for Jonathan, because I took him to the local doctor first. So as soon as I took him to the hospital, we were advised again from the hospital that he's still having the flu. And because Jonathan was having a symptoms of diarrhea of the antibiotic that we were giving to him because of the symptoms Jonathan was having. So the doctor just checked him and told me that he advised again, this is again from the hospital, that I was advised with just giving him fluid, pushing him with fluids, and keep doing the same process that I was being recommended by the local doctor. Keep monitoring him, replacing what's been coming out from Jonathan, and just to use the medicines exactly how I've been told to. So I was trying so hard, because I already took him to the local doctor and I was thinking, oh, I'm here in the hospital, and I tried to advocate on my son, trying to let them know. I was pushing parts of symptoms, telling, oh, he got this. It's getting worse from the last time I took him to the GP. And the doctor said, it will cover by this medicines. And I tried another symptoms. Oh, but this symptoms is looking to me I need to be worried about. But the doctor said he's sick at that moment. It will cause him also because he's sick. So I tried different parts of the symptoms, that trying one by one to let the doctor knows as a mom that he needs to do further tests. But because the doctor just monitored and how he just checked Jonathan and said no to me, I'm happy to just discharge you home with the same process you've been doing. The right thing. You have been doing the right thing, mom. Just go home and keep monitoring him. Just keep doing the same process. And if you think 2 to 3 days that Jonathan is, there's no progressing or improvement, then you bring him back again. So as a mom, I tried my best to ever get on my son to tell them what the situation is, but they were happy to just discharge us home. So I went.
E kalo ka taki pe, I know ogu toi si ipe tau taimi. But I just wanted to sort of get to understand, like, where is Jonathan right now, though? Do we know what his current situation is?
The current situation of Jonathan now at the moment is before Jonathan is the situation of him before he can see, before he got sick. So all the situation Jonathan went through now, he lost his vision. Before he can speak, say words, now Jonathan can't say words or can't communicate. Mm. Before Jonathan can eat and can use his hand and to use it for him, for feeding himself, but now he's just laying on bed like a paralyzed child. He doesn't do anything. Mm. So I'm the one who's doing the care and doing the help for him to feed him.
Wow.
Before he can stand, sit on his own, crawl. And now Jonathan is just laying on bed. He can't, when he sits, I need to support him. When he stands, his stiffness of the body is, you have to support him. He needs a lot of support of trying to bend his feet, trying to move his feet, because so you can let him know that this is a position of sitting up. This is a position you need to move your feet from that side to that side. So at the moment, Jonathan's situation is just laying on bed with the vomiting, because the situation of Jonathan's communication is part of me and Jonathan's communication is vomiting. Yeah. So when he's unsettled, he will vomit. When he doesn't tolerate anything, he vomits. When he's feeling sick that I can't really tell, he just vomits so I can catch up. What is he trying to tell me? What is the symptom he's trying to show me about the situation he's going through?
Kalo, I'm going to have to apologize deeply. We can carry this conversation offline, but we're going to have to end up right there just because our show is coming to an end. But I do really appreciate you sharing, and we will be able to finish this offline. But again, malo apito.
Thank you. Thank you, Agnes.
That, of course, is Kalolaine Taeloa, mother of 2-year-old Jonathan Taeloa, who is fighting to stay in New Zealand after being denied a visa for medical purposes. Now, that brings us to the end of our show. You can find our stories when you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. We'll be back again 6 a.m. PNG time tomorrow. You can hear us again this afternoon, 5 p.m. PNG time. Up next, it is your news, and coming up after that, it's Nita Daily. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.